Today on EdgeFX.
And that requires education that the built environment matters a lot more than we thought it did, right? Because most people think there are, you know, blah city parks, and then there's the cool landmark park like the Brooklyn Bridge Park or something like that. And my argument is, no. It's all architecture. It all matters.
Geographer Carly Griffith talks with Sarah Williams Goldhagen, writer, architectural critic, and author of the new book, Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. They discuss how our brains respond to spaces we inhabit and how we can improve the quality of architecture and urban design in the face of hyper-urbanization.
Thank you so much for joining us on EdgeFX. We are here to talk about your new book, Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Can you start us off with an introduction to what this book is about?
The book is basically an offering of a new paradigm for how we should understand the relationship between us as humans to the built environment, and a very clear setting out of the basic principles of how people experience the environments that they mostly live in, which are built environments, really from the ground up, how built environments affect our emotions, they affect our cognitions, they affect our physical health, our mental health, and so on. And I wrote the book in part because I realized that with new technologies to study the brain and so on, our entire understanding of how the brain and the mind functions has been completely revolutionized in the last 25 years, continuing to be revolutionized, and that nobody had really sat down and figured out, well, what does that mean for how people experience the built environment? I mean, the last book that was written on the subject really was in the 1950s by Steen Rasmussen, which is called Experience Architecture, which was one, only about architecture, and two, using Gestalt theories, another now outdated theories. And I knew that there was this form of knowledge called embodied cognition that was actually started out in cognitive linguistics and philosophy about 20 years ago that was being confirmed as, in fact, the model of human cognition that was correct. And so I just took and researched all this knowledge and thought, okay, well, what does that mean for, you know, for the role of the built environments and people's experiences in their lives?
So I was fascinated by the way you were able to bring in cognitive neuroscience and environmental psychology to bear on architecture. I know that you are trained as an art historian, and in addition to your prolific career as a writer, you taught architectural history and theory for many years at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Mm-hmm. So what led you on this journey to shift away from a focus on traditional architectural history to incorporate research in cognitive neuroscience, environmental psychology, and investigations of how architecture, landscape architecture, and urban design mutually inform each other?
It's a great question. It's a question I get a lot. Actually, I'll give a longer answer and then you stop me if it's getting too long.
Okay. Which
is that the reason I got interested in architecture initially, I mean, my father was a city planner, so I was aware that politics were in the built environment and that the built environment is a shaping social entity. But I really started to get interested in the built environment because of how profound the aesthetic experience of it is, which I realized very early on. I recount in the book walking without really knowing where I'm going in an Italian city, which I've just arrived at. I was a teenager, and then coming upon the Piazza del Duomo in Florence, which is just such a staggering sight and a kind of whole body, emotional, physical, and cognitive experience in a way that I'm also very interested in art. It, that even really, really, really great paintings don't kind of duplicate that experience. And that kept happening to me. And in college, I discovered art history, and I've always been more of a word person than a science person. So I knew I wasn't going to go and work on rats or mice. And art history seemed like the perfect fit. I loved learning about historical context and thinking about artistic intention. I was always very theoretically inclined when I was getting my art history degree. So I did that, and that was a point in the academy, in academic art history, which was very heavily influenced by structuralism and post-structuralism. And so the emphasis in most theoretical approaches that I was exposed to was really relentlessly on the social construction of reality and the historical construction of reality. There was a teeny, teeny, tiny little wing of the academy that was interested in phenomenology. But in the built environment, phenomenology for most people meant Heidegger, who, as we now know, was a fascist. And even then, that was pretty obvious. I mean, he was very anti-modernity, very nostalgic, and it was totally problematic. So that was one person who was talking, trying to theorize experience, and in building dwelling thinking, theorizing experience of the built environment, but it was politically extremely problematic. And there were a few people who read Merleau-Ponty, who was actually trained psychologist. But within architecture and even in art history, people didn't really know what to do with it. And also because of the politics of structuralism and post-structuralism, the basic paradigm was, if you're not talking about these abstract social structures and the way that they're structuring people's reality and consciousness and ideologies, and instead you're shifting the focus to explore individual and social experience, then you're neglecting the things that really matter, which are these abstract politicized ideologies and social structures and so on. So phenomenology and architectural built environmental experience was kind of a forbidden topic. So I got very interested. I mean, I was always interested in Kahn just because I loved his architecture. That's really the only reason I wrote about him. And then I sort of found interesting things to say, and I did a lot with historical and social context and so on. And even by the end of the book, I was sort of trying to theorize experience, but I didn't really, I was aware that I didn't quite have the tools to do it. And, you know, the word situated from my first book, Lucan's Situated Modernism, is a very clear indication of what my direction was going to be next. And then I was teaching at Harvard, teaching in design schools, not only at Harvard, but for the longest time at Harvard. And then I was invited to be the architecture critic for the New Republic. And that really kind of threw me back into thinking about experience, because when I started, I thought, you know, I'm not just going to sort of be one of a thumbs up, thumbs down, wow, that's great, wow, that's terrible kind of critic. I wanted to really develop a very serious set of critical criteria by which I was going to judge things. And I wanted to make sure the readers knew those were my criteria and why they were important. And when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, what's really important is how people experience things, right? You know, you can judge a building's technological prowess, but if it's a horrible place to be, then it really doesn't matter how technologically innovative it is. And I started reading, my husband gave me this book called Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. Lakoff is a cognitive linguist and Johnson is a philosopher, which starts to lay out, and then they've written subsequent books about this, the theories of embodied cognition. And at the same time that I was reading and sort of inculcating the ideas and Metaphors We Live By, which presents how non-conscious and fully embodied the structures as well as the content of our cognition is, I was reading kind of in the general kind of popular scientific, if you want to call it that, like Scientific American and stuff, findings that were coming out because of these new technologies about how the mind worked. I mean, one that most people know, or a lot of people know, is mirror neurons. which mirror neurons, this doesn't pertain directly to the built environment, but it's very well known, so it's a good example. If I look at you and you smile, good. The same neurons that fire when I smile fire when I just watch you smile. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the way that humans learn so quickly, because they're constantly mentally simulating things that they see. And so when the mirror neuron stuff came out, I thought, how does that work in terms of the built environment? I mean, when you look at a door handle, do you imagine opening that door, even if you're nowhere near it and not going to open it? That kind of thing. Turns out the answer is yes. So, and more of this kind of information, our understanding of memory has been completely changed. Our understanding of spatial navigation, and I could go on. And I realized this is something that really needs to be retheorized. I mean, really, the last serious book that was written on architectural experience was written by Rudolf Arnheim. It never really took off in the 80s, I think. And that was based on Gestalt, which at this point is a 50, 60-year-old theory of and only a visual perception. And I knew that things were much more complicated.
I was fascinated by your discussion, what you just mentioned, of how our non-conscious and conscious mind mutually informs our perception of and interaction with the built environment. Could mm-hmm. you define for us, you use the terms egocentric and allocentric. Could you define those terms for us and elaborate on how design can and should engage both of these to be successful?
Sure. First, I'm going to back up a little bit. First, mm-hmm. talk about non-conscious.
Sure.
Then I'll go to egocentric and allocentric. One of the things that's emerged really clearly from this research is that most of what we think is not conscious. Now, the reason I use non-conscious rather than unconscious, unconscious is stuff that you can never really get at. You know, it has to do with the autonomic systems and so on that in our brains that dictate things without our awareness. And, you know, you can't change the way your heart beats by thinking about it, for example. But there's a huge band of information that we're assimilating all the time that we're not aware of. And we could become aware of it if we really paid attention and slowed ourselves down. But of course, life is fast. And, you know, so we're mostly not aware of it. And the built environment is appropriated mostly in that way. So a lot of what I say about how people experience the built environment may sound strange to people because they think, well, I don't think that. And I don't think this. But yeah, right, you don't. But that doesn't mean it's not happening. So back to the egocentric and allocentric, mm-hmm. my favorite concepts, actually.
Yeah, I loved your discussion of this in the book.
Thank you. So egocentric, you know, we have this kind of pitter-patter of conscious thought in our heads, you know, this little narrative that tells me I'm sitting here talking to you on Skype and you know, looking at you and you're looking at me. And then there is the allocentric self, which is really sort of, if you imagine yourself not from where you are and inside your head, but as a point on a map, for example, you're an object in space. Every one of us is an object in space and among other objects. So it's really the difference between your internal narrative and yourself as if you were looking at yourself from outside yourself. And the reason I use it in the book is because there are moments when the built environment can actually shift you from your own egocentric narrative, which is what we mostly live in, to a sense of yourself allocentrically as an object in space.
Mm-hmm. You talk to build on this idea of non-conscious and conscious. You talk a lot about the importance of the built environment to our self-actualization and to the personal narratives that we tell about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you elaborate on two of your own experiences in Italy and India in the book. Can mm-hmm. you tell us about those experiences and how they shaped your self-actualization and subsequently your academic work?
Well, the first one is the one I was referring to before right. in Florence. And that was really fascinating because I had no background in Renaissance. I was traveling with my parents in Italy. It was my high school graduation present, the trip mm-hmm. with them. And we'd had a terrible argument. My parents did not have a good marriage. So there was like all this back history of this incredible tension in our family. And then sometimes it would just flare. And this was one of these moments we were driving in, and I happened to be very good at reading a map. So they couldn't find their way in. So I read the map. I navigated us to the hotel. And then I just said, I'm going for a walk, not really knowing a thing about what Florence was. And then ended up, I think the first thing I really saw, was the baptistry. You know, I could actually reconstruct the experience for you for reasons I'll explain. It was just this blunt, octagonal, white marble with green Pietà Serena stripes building. I didn't even know what a baptistry was. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't even really identify. And then on the oblique view was Giotto's bell tower, which is this beautifully kind of lacily Gothic, wonderfully vertical thing. And the opposition of those things just stopped me. I just stood there. And all the tension of the last 45 minutes was gone. It affected me emotionally. I became fascinated. I thought, you know, what's the relationship of this to that? What, chronologically, you know, which was built first? What are they for? And so on and so forth. And it was a very powerful experience. Similarly, when I was in India, I mean, India is an intense place to be. Uh-huh. No matter when you're and where you are.
A little different than Italy.
A little different from Italy. And I was traveling as a graduate student, so I had virtually no money. So I was always dirty and always sweaty and always running around and taking pictures. And I was in Delhi and had been in the old city and the fort in the old city. I was basically doing what my guidebook told me to do. And I ended up at the end of the day in the Lodi Gardens, which is this huge park right in downtown Delhi. And I came upon, again, ironically enough, an octagonal structure that sort of expresses the weight of its gravity. It's sandstone, so it's kind of earth-colored. Through a canting of the walls, it was a tomb, Muhammad Shah's tomb. And it was, in Western terms, you say it was kind of Romanesque. I mean, it was sort of big and blunt and heavy and forceful. And again, I just was stopped. It was the end of the day. The sun was setting. It was beautiful out. And I was in nature and looking at this thing. And all the kind of tension and dirt and blech of the day went away. The second episode I recount in the chapter that I have on nature, which is, you know, part of it was that I was, you know, India is so crowded and everything is so close. And then, you know, there was this kind of horizontal sweep, which was an enormous relief.
Yeah, I'd like to build on your mention of the nature chapter, if I can. You talk about the hyper-urbanization our world faces in the next 50 years and beyond in some quite terrifying statistics that you outline.
They are.
Within that context, do you think that we need to redefine our relationship to nature? And how can we support, is it possible to support the interdependence of the built and natural environments within that context?
Obviously, it is. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't have written that part of the book. I mean, what we know is that physiologically, and this comes from as much from evolutionary psychology, but it's also very much confirmed by studies of cognition, that we have powerful, powerful, and almost immediate responses to nature. If you take a hospital patient who's in a wheelchair and you take them from his or her room and you wheel them into a garden, within 5 seconds, his or her heart rate will settle down. Stress levels will go down within 10 or 15 minutes, cortisol levels, and so on. So nature We know, for example, that daylight, the lack of daylight, is implicated in some mental illnesses. We know the curative effects of daylight. We know that exposure to morning sunlight will accelerate the mitigation of a mania in bipolar patients, whereas afternoon sunlight, much less so. So we have pretty fine-grained knowledge. We know the difference between people's responses to landscape paintings versus looking at actual landscapes. There's been a lot of research on this. People need nature. And the statistics in the book, they are really frightening. I mean, they're staggering. You know, if China builds one city of 1 or 2 million people every year for the next 30 years, they'll only just barely be able to contain all the people who are coming into the cities. So how can we manage this? There are always ways to integrate nature into even very high-rise residential buildings. There's always a way to make sure that natural light gets to places. It's a matter of building regulations and municipal regulations. I think I do recount in the book one regulation that, you know, China, we always think of China as this horror of urbanism, right? But they actually have a regulation that even in the highest rise building, the first floor apartments have to be oriented so they get 3 hours of daylight on the shortest day of the year.
Yeah, I was fascinated when I read that.
Look, if we just did that, that's better. Because, I say nature, people think of greenery. It's not only greenery. It's greenery, it's natural light, it's variation, and so on and so forth.
You talk very evocatively in your book. You give several examples of constructed objects, buildings, that successfully are responsive to the climate, the topography, and the materials of their site. Could you walk us through an example that you think is successful in doing that?
Well, there are a lot of different examples.
Salk Institute was one that you devoted a lot Salk of time
was
to.
One. I'll talk about the Salk in a minute, but one that's a little more subtle, which I like a lot, is the Clifford Still Museum in Denver. Which, if you look at it from the outside, you know, if you saw it in pictures, for example, you'd really just think, you know, as an overall building, you really just think, well, that's kind of an abstract blank concrete box. But in fact, it has very subtle textural variations on the exterior facade and a quite sculpted texture in parts of the facade. And then on the interior, it's a two-floor building, but there are a lot of cuts down to the first floor. The entire ceiling is a skylight that filters light in. And so the building is kind of like a light sieve that just all day long, it's looking different because as the sunlight changes and the shadows change, it becomes a different building. And the interior light doesn't shift that much, obviously, because that wouldn't be good for looking at art. But it's filtered enough so that you know whether it's afternoon or morning. There are also like little opportunities, like there's a little, it's really just a slip of an outdoor garden that you can go to. But there are opportunities to go outside, to come back inside, to get shifting light, and so on. There are always opportunities to find ways to work with the climate, with the site, with nature, with topography. The Salk Institute is this really brilliant example of, in the reading, the analysis that I give it in the book, based on the multi-sensory way in which we actually experience the environment, is it constructs, by managing our attentional resources, a kind of a radical shift. Your first experience of the place, practically every architectural move he's making is meant to cast your attention back onto the site and onto nature. It's an extraordinary site. You're looking out at the Pacific Ocean, the horizon, it's beautiful, et cetera, et cetera. And you're elevated above it. So you're really not even much looking at the building. You're just kind of following the path and going in there. And then all of a sudden, pew, you know, you come into that central plaza and there's noise there and you begin to hear that water and you're just surrounded by building itself, but the building itself has some of the same textural properties that the Clifford Steel Building has in a very different way. It uses wood, and the wood is a demarcator of functionality because wood is where the private offices for the scientists are. And then this beautiful, incredible concrete, which if it just, it almost looks like velvet, and it almost feels like velvet. It has this kind of bluish tincture, which took Kahn apparently months and months and months to figure out what the right hue was. Whereas before, you're looking out at nature, which of course is the subject of biological research, and it's the Salk Institute for Biological Research. And then you develop this sort of whole body, multi-sensory and multimodal, meaning both sensory neurons and motor neurons are involved. Multisensory and multimodal relationship to this building is very palpable, and it's part of the reason that people love that place. I would say a good deal of the reason people love that place.
Thank you for those examples. I found that your descriptions are very evocative, and they help to flesh out the argument in ways that I could understand spatially.
Mm-hmm.
So
good.
I'm interested to shift to your discussion of how design informs our social lives. For example, you talk about how buildings can transition from scenes to events. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about that?
Can I shift that a little bit?
Certainly, yes.
Which is that, okay, so one of the big challenges in the book, because I was writing about the experience of users of the built environment, I've always been interested in the political and social dimensions of the built environment. I mean, as I said, my father was a city planner. If I knew one thing, I knew that this was a political entity and socially constructed. I knew that unlike that split between post-structuralism, structuralism, phenomenology in the academy, that by attending to individual experience, you were also attending to social experience. There wasn't a split between them. So I really needed to work out what that relationship was between the social and the individual. And I found it in the work of this, who was actually a behavioral psychologist named Roger Barker. This is actually much older work in the 1950s. Barker was trained as a behaviorist, but was very critical of the profession because all the experiments that the behaviorists were doing were taking place in labs. And he thought people don't live in labs. They live in environments. So, you know, you're controlling, editing out a major factor here. And so he set up this psychological research station to study people in their environments. And he assigned one researcher to each kid in a big class in the elementary school. So the researcher really literally followed the kid from the time they woke up in the morning to go to school, eat breakfast, go to school, go to chess club, do the family dinner back home. They collected research for months. And what they found is that they could predict more about a kid's behavior from where they were than from who they were, from their individual psychology. And that it's consistent with everything else I say in the book. And it also shows how profoundly social and socializing in whatever way the built environment is. Scenes and events fit into this in that it's sort of, the scenes and events is a little bit of an analog to the egocentric and allocentric, and that if you look at something as a scene, you're not placing yourself in it. I mean, these are terms psychologists use a lot. If you're in an event is something in which you're participating. And we all have events all day long, which is the ways that we're interacting with other people in environments in an egocentric way, actually. So it's a sort of a shift. The event is the egocentric and the scene is an allocentric. There's a lot more to be done, but it's clear, and this is something that's a little better trod territory than some of the other stuff I cover in the book, that social conduct is profoundly shaped by the built environment. I mean, they've done studies of shapes of room. If you have a room of equal area that's square versus one that's rectangle, people will interact with each other in profoundly different ways. And, you know, you don't realize that this is happening, but it is. It's happening all the time. So I could give other examples, or I could go back to something about memory that I wanted to say.
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Memory.
So you asked a while ago, there's this material is so rich, so many different dimensions to it. You asked a while ago about memories.
Right.
And I said that our understanding of memories has been really quite radically shifted with these new technologies and just new research in the last 20 years. So when I was a kid, we were taught that memory, you know, there was probably some kind of place in the brain. That was our memory place, and that's where the memories were stored. Well, that's not the way it works at all. You have an experience which comes in through all your sensory portals, and there are many, many more than five. And then it's consolidated into what we call a long-term episodic or autobiographical memory in a certain portion of the brain, which is called the hippocampus. And then it goes back out to all the sensory portals from which it came. So basically, when you have a memory again, when you remember your memory, you're more or less reconstructing it every time. Now, the reason this becomes so fascinating when you think about the built environment is that the hippocampus has two functions, which is the consolidation of long-term memories on the one hand, and spatial navigation and place recognition on the other. So there are three things along that dimension that the hippocampus does. It manages spatial navigation. It manages building recognition. We actually know that there are neurons in the brain called place recognition neurons, and they're building recognition neurons in the brain, in the hippocampus. And what they discovered is that this long-term consolidation of memories that happens in the hippocampus happens in the same places that spatial navigation and building recognition and place recognition happen, such that we actually can't form episodic memories that don't retain something of that place. So the larger implication of that is really nothing less than the construction of our identities, since our identities are constructed through our memories. The construction of our identities is dependent upon place. I mean, it's inextricable from place. It's not dependent upon it. And this became really clear to me when I, in the process of writing this book, it took me a long time. I had been living in this kind of leafy, beautiful, older suburb in Massachusetts. And I moved to New York City, and we got this wonderful place, and it happened to be in East Harlem, which is also Spanish Harlem. It has the largest concentration of social housing in the United States. And the social housing is dreadful, pretty much by any standard, and it's terribly maintained and so on. And so here I was writing this book about the importance of the built environment to the construction of identity, among other things. And I would walk by these projects and I would think, you know, what are these projects doing to these people? Like, what sort of identities are they developing, living in places that so clearly communicate to them that they don't matter? So that's just something that I wanted to put in there, because I think it's a really important dimension that goes to what I show in the book, is that the built environment affects us so profoundly that we really need to change the way we value it. We as a society need to change the way we value it. Because it's about how your kid learns and your mother heals and in from a hospital stay and so on.
Yeah, that actually leads right into my next set of questions, which has a core tenet of your book seems to be that good design is not a luxury, or to put it another way, that it requires the same resources to construct a building that impairs our capabilities as it does to erect a structure that enhances them. To take the example of Harlem, where you now live on the ground, that's not that's not how the built environment plays out. And it is, it's much more regulated by a market-driven approach than a rights-driven approach. And your thoughts on how we can make design accessible to communities, perhaps, you know, in your own community of Harlem, that haven't had access to them in the past. And as part of that question, how we can shift from a market-driven approach to a rights-based approach.
I don't have the answer. I mean, a lot of things need to change to go from one to the other. But it can change. It just requires the political and social will to do it. And that requires education that the built environment matters a lot more than we thought it did, right? Because most people think that there's this neutral thing called the built environment, and then there's these cool things called architecture. Oh, and there are kind of, you know, blah city parks, and then there's the cool landmark park, like the Brooklyn Bridge Park or something like that. And my argument is, no, it's all architecture. It all matters. So how do we go from one to the other? The analogy that I like to give, and it's part of why I use the term built environment. The other reason is because I talk about it's all, it's urban design, it's landscape architecture, it's not just architecture, right? But the other thing that, the other work that built environment did for me is that, again, I'm dating myself, but when I was a kid, growing up in the 70s, 60s and 70s, nature was nature. I mean, particularly in the 60s, it was like, it was trees, it was forests, it was streams, it was, you know, what nature is. It was lawns and pastures and stuff like that. But then slowly, people began to talk about nature in the public sphere in a very different way. They began to talk about it as the environment. And the environment was an integrated entity. It wasn't just forests. It was forests and streams and things like that. And all of it. And all these different parts worked together as a system. And had the other department, this was called the environmental revolution. And the other part was that one part could affect something else way down the line. And finally, when you began to talk about nature as the environment, it became a socio-political entity. And so then the EPA was set up, right? And basically what I'm saying is that that kind of shift needs to happen with the built environment. You know, all the things that have to happen for that shift to take place. I mean, I was actually, I'll give you just, this is sort of an anecdote, but I was on a panel about the book a couple of weeks ago, sponsored by the Citizens Housing and Planning Council of New York and Cornell University. And it was an interview between me and someone else, but then other people came up, other discussants came up, and one of them was Richard Roberts, who is the former housing commissioner for the city of New York. And he said, I'm going to give this book to every policymaker I know, because this is what we've been trying to tell people for years, but now we have the documentation and the proof. So, you know, if the book has that kind of impact, mm-hmm. great.
Yes, absolutely.
Slow, but that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a helpful comparison to compare it to a similar shift in nature environment. I want to touch base on the idea of education. You mentioned early on in your response that education will be a big part of this shift in how we value and construct the built environment. So you talk about the need for a professional design workforce that is equipped to take on this challenge. So what do you see as the current state of design education, and what changes do you think should happen?
Well, there's the education of designers, which is one thing, and then there's the general education about design. So to continue with the analogy of the environmental revolution and the so-called built environmental revolution, which I'm calling for, is that every kid from kindergarten, first grade on learns about the environment, right? And they have, you know, they're taken out into nature walks and they're taught stuff, and they're taught that it's really important that they know at least some stuff about the environment. So more generally, that's a shift that has to happen, which is that people have to become and taught more aware that design, when I'm talking about the built environment, I'm talking about the design of the built environment. So that's the more general public awareness. And then we do have to change how architects are educated as well. Designers are educated. Landscape architects less so, because I think they have a better grasp of environmental psychology and the relationship of environmental psychology, which is only a small part of this, to design. But architects, urban designers, and so on need just sort of basic training in how people experience environments. And one question I'm often asked is, well, you know, isn't it different? Isn't it different for someone in China? Isn't it different for men than for women? Isn't it different for someone who lived in the 18th century from the 21st century? Sure. I'm not saying that everybody's exactly the same or that everybody has exactly the same experiences, but we're all humans. We all have eyes that face outward, that have a very small cone of vision in which your vision is precise. We understand front and back. We know that back is something we can't see and front is something you can. And so there's a lot that is generalizable more generally. And this is information that architects are simply not taught. Neither are urban designers, really, for the most part. At one, the information wasn't there. Well, now it's there because I pulled it together and there's other books out there too. And two, because the training in, I have the most experience in architecture because I taught in architecture schools, the training has always come out of more of a fine arts tradition. My book is very scientifically grounded. And people are sort of like, whoa, you know, you're going to tell me what to do. I mean, I can't design red buildings. I can't. Architects are very skittish about all of this, you know, because it just seems so maybe boring. I don't know. And limiting, but it's not limiting at all. I mean, that's why in that chapter where I talk about some of the design principles that you could actually get out of this, you know, they're very broad and you can combine them in all sorts of different ways, as I show from the examples, but you do have to know them.
What are some of those basic design principles? Can you outline a couple for us?
Well, I mean, in addition to using nature, one of the things that's pretty clear, part of the reason our experience of the built environment is mostly non-conscious is because built environments are mostly static and immovable, and we live in them, which means that we have no reason as the human beings that we are to pay much attention to them on a regular basis. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is designing environments to change. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. You can do that, and Rem Koolhaas is a genius in his early work at doing that, using people. You know, the kind of social constellations that you are exposed to through these kind of sectional innovations that he did that are now quite common, means that you always have kind of diagonal views to other people and other places, and you can see other people looking at you and so on. And so this heightens your awareness of the environment and how it's constructed in place. Another way you can build change into, I mean, my example there, I think a famous and clear example of that is the old Paris Opera House, where you have all these different levels and slow ascents up through these long, shallow staircases and so on. You can use daylight, which shifts all day long. You can use the weather. You can use materials that respond differently. You know, part of the reason that wood is such a great material is it absorbs sound. It's warmer rather than colder to the touch. And, you know, it creates different soundscapes depending upon who's in the room and what's going on. So figuring out ways to make whatever environment you're designing be new every time someone comes there. Is that's one way.
So I have one more question for us. I know we're nearing the end of our time. There are many things that I respect about your book, but I really respect that you write not just for an academic audience, but you invite a general audience into the topic to create the kind of book that, as you said in your anecdote, could be handed out to policymakers to inform policy. And you also extend beyond the role of a scholar to that of an advocate. So can you close our conversation? Can you talk about what you see as the most urgent issues and challenges of our time that make the stakes of the built environment in our individual and collective welfare so high? And the second part of that question would be, what comes next?
There are more people to house. There's simply many, many more people in the world than there were even when I was 30. And they need housing. They need schools to go to. So there's going to be a ton of building. That my whole first chapter goes into the statistics of that, which are really just staggering. And now we know. The book makes it clear. Now we know your kids can learn better or worse, depending upon how the environment they learn in is designed. You can heal more quickly from surgery, depending upon how better or worse the hospital room that you're in is designed, and so on. That's the sense of urgency and why these things have to happen now. Why? And, you know, I'm basically taking, I'll give you a little bit of an anecdote. Design, which is seen as a pretty effete practice. When I first graduated from college, I met some architects who were really into fashion and, you know, were like super interested in high fashion, which of course is design too. And I thought, wait a minute, like this is like a category mistake. I mean, we're talking about buildings that people live in, you know, it doesn't really have that much to do with Ralph Lauren. So the shifting of the value of the way that society values the environment and toward a capabilities approach and a rights-based approach, as you correctly call it, look, it's a heavy lift, particularly in ever more aggressively capitalist economy like the United States. You know, there's a reason that Western Europe's built environment looks better than Americans does. And that's because they have a much more palpable sense of the public sphere, and they have a much more palpable sense of, and people are educated in the importance of design pretty early on. I recently heard the example of John F. Kennedy announcing that in 1961 or something like that, that we were going to put a man on the moon within 10 years, and everybody thought he was nuts. And then, lo and behold, 9 years later, person was walking on the moon. It really is a question of developers understood that there are financial reasons to do this as well as rights-based reasons to do it.
Yeah, I appreciate the bold optimism of your book. And I think it's a tone that, as you say, we need to move the needle to move forward the conversation. So that concludes my questions. Thank you very much, and I want to congratulate you on the success of your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Carly Griffith, a PhD student in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was speaking with Sarah Williams Goldhagen, the author of Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Out now from HarperCollins Publishers. You can learn more about her work at sarahwilliamsgoldhagen.com. You've been listening to EdgeFX, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment, and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by Carly Griffith, Brian Hamilton, and me, Sarah Thomas. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes featuring writers Kurt Miney and Gavin Van Horn, historians Louis Warren and Richard White, anthropologist Anna Singh, and sociologist Jason Moore. Get those and all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the Edge FX podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review to help new listeners discover it. And as always, keep up with a steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgefx.net.